Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Uncommon Valor, the recon company that earned 5 Medals of Honor and included America's most decorated Green Beret, by Stephen L. Moore, narrated by Sean Renett. Prologue. Sergeant First Class Bob Howard lay unconscious as hellacious volumes of semi- and full-automatic weapons fire made confetti of the dense green jungle foliage all around his crumpled body. It was December 30th, 1968, and Howard's 33-man recon platoon was being shredded by 2 companies of North Vietnamese infantrymen. Near him lay his platoon commander, a young first lieutenant whose body had been ripped by bullets and grenade fragments. 4 South Vietnamese members of Howard's platoon had also been cut down. One was already dead, and the other 3 were writhing in agony. Howard was raised in near poverty by his grandmother in Opelika, Alabama. He was now a specimen of physical fitness, a powerfully built 6-footer with a square jaw and a fierce sense of patriotism. A quiet, unassuming character, he was considered the epitome of bravery in combat. He had already been written up for the Medal of Honor 2x, only to have the citations downgraded to a Distinguished Service Cross and a Silver Star. But now the fierce warrior was in agony, with shrapnel wounds to his hands, groin, and lower legs. Blown backward by the force of a grenade, Howard fought to regain consciousness and struggled to see through the blood gushing from an ugly head wound. As his senses slowly returned, he detected the most vile stench, the scent of burning human flesh. He pulled himself upright and spotted a North Vietnamese soldier brandishing a flamethrower. The enemy infantryman was moving about the kill zone, roasting the bodies of Howard's wounded platoon mates with liquid fire. The grisly massacre was playing out in Cambodia, far from any friendly troops, in an area where the American government denied having any military presence. Bob Howard knew there would be no cavalry racing to his rescue. Most of the Green Beret's web gear had been ripped away, and his automatic weapon was useless, blown all to hell by the enemy grenade. To the left of the soldier with the flamethrower, Howard spied his gravely wounded lieutenant screaming in agony. He fumbled to retrieve an M-33 hand grenade strapped to his left side and struggled to remove the pin with fingers that had been slashed by red-hot shrapnel. As he did so, the North Vietnamese Army NVA soldier spotted him and turned his flamethrower in Howard's direction. In the midst of rising smoke, rattling gunfire, and the screams of dying men, Howard and his opponent made direct eye contact. The American felt his enemy was experiencing a smug sense of satisfaction, knowing he was about to burn a Green Beret to death. Howard gripped his hand grenade as final thoughts rushed through his head. "I'm about to be burnt up or blown up, but at least I'm going to take this guy out with me." Sergeant Howard was stationed at Special Forces Forward Operating Base No. 2, FOB 2, which was established in May 1966 near Con Tum in the Central Highlands region of South Vietnam. This advanced base served as the operations center for a recon company of an elite U.S. military unit that fell under the auspices of the Military Assistance Command Vietnam, MAC-V. The unit, codenamed the Studies and Observations Group, SOG, was composed strictly of volunteers, Army Green Berets, a handful of Navy SEALs, Sea, Air, and Land, Central Intelligence Agency, CIA field agents, and indigenous personnel. SOG reported directly to the Joint Chiefs of Staff, JCS, and the White House, running black ops, top-secret operations so classified that the very existence of the covert unit was denied by the U.S. government. SOG men took on the most dangerous assignments, working behind enemy lines to penetrate NVA facilities in Cambodia, Laos, and South Vietnam along the heavily defended Ho Chi Minh Trail. MAC-V organized SOG in 1964 to conduct strategic reconnaissance missions, capture enemy soldiers for intelligence, identify targets for bombing missions, conduct psychological missions, such as sabotaging enemy ammunition, and even to attempt the rescue of American prisoners of war, POW. SOG's recon men were also responsible for saving the lives of downed pilots during so-called bright light missions conducted deep behind enemy lines. SOG's Green Berets operated in small recon teams of generally two or three Americans, with three or more indigenous soldiers. The SOG teams were often inserted behind enemy lines by helicopter, with the American soldiers decked out in sterile uniforms, stripped of insignia, and carrying foreign weapons. If killed or captured, their existence in their area of operations, AO, would be denied by the U.S. government. In 1969, MACV SOG documented its ratio of NVA soldiers killed to each lost Green Beret at 150-1, the highest documented kill ratio of any American unit in the war. In many cases, the SOG teams went in under enemy fire and were pursued by NVA trackers from the moment they inserted into the jungle. They remained on the ground for days or even more than a week at a time, with meager rations and only the ammunition each man could carry, often engaging platoon to division-sized enemy forces until the surviving members could be extracted by helicopter. Sometimes entire teams were wiped out. According to Major John Plaster, author of the first detailed history of the SOG, the recon company at FOB 2 Kontum was the Vietnam War's most highly decorated unit, with five Medal of Honor MOH recipients. These five sky blue ribbons were awarded between February 1967 and January 1970. Within that same stretch, FOB 2 recon men also received eight Distinguished Service Crosses, DSC, the nation's second highest award for valor, and innumerable other awards. Purple Hearts were awarded by the unit at a pace unparalleled in American wars of the 20th century, with team casualties sometimes reaching 100%. Oftentimes, Special Forces, SF, troopers, declined the submission of paperwork for a Purple Heart, or simply did not report minor shrapnel wounds. As far as they were concerned, it was all in a day's work. It would be impossible to relate all of the covert missions run by the Kontum Recon Company in a book of this length. Many of the reports and documents pertaining to these missions were destroyed to maintain the secrecy of SOG. Reconstructing the story of how FOB 2 Kontum took shape was made possible largely through the knowledge of the original 33 Green Berets who began running operations from the base. These same men added improvements to the compound. The FOB slowly increased in size, incorporating more recon teams, RTs, and a reaction battalion, until the number of American servicemen stationed there had doubled. This small base would slowly grow in strength during its first 2 years of operation, and the records it would amass for the numbers of troops involved are inspiring. In the official language of the Medal of Honor citation, each of the five SOG recipients received the nation's highest award for conspicuous gallantry and intrepidity in the risk of his life above and beyond the call of duty, while tending to the welfare of wounded comrades. Some of these five perished in the course of the mission for which they were later honored. Bob Howard was wounded on 14 occasions, received 8 Purple Hearts, and emerged from Vietnam as the most highly decorated soldier since World War II's Audie Murphy. However, this is not only the story of five MOH men, but also one about the 8 Kontum-based DSC recipients and dozens of other warriors who were acknowledged with other awards. In some cases, the most valiant received no formal recognition at all, either due to the eccentricities of the awards board process or the fact that there were often no surviving witnesses to the heroic actions of the man in question. The SOG warriors were supported by a wide variety of aviators, flying prop-driven assault planes, single-engine Cessnas, fast-moving jets, and highly vulnerable choppers, all manned by personnel tasked with providing aerial cover, radio relay support, and life-saving extractions that often took heavy tolls. Relating the true tale of Kontum's FOB 2 Recon Company is possible thanks to the participation of many. Because of the highly classified nature of SOG's existence, many of the missions remained unknown to the American public for decades after the close of hostilities in Vietnam. The author reviewed surviving military documents that have since been declassified, but his primary sources were the veterans themselves. dozens of former Green Berets, airmen, and even a retired general who served 2 years as chief of SOG during Vietnam. They are the men who made the covert actions of SOG so highly successful. Their sacrifices were only sometimes later acknowledged with a military award, but their conduct under fire speaks volumes. They were an uncommon bunch who displayed uncommon valor. Chapter 1. The Khon-Tum 33. Steve Goth suppressed an excited smile as he glanced over at Al Keller. He thought to himself, "This is it." The two had known each other long enough that even such quick eye contact said it all. After long months of training and preparation, the close friends had finally reached the pinnacle of their short military careers, the chance to join a top-secret Special Forces team, so covert even its name was unknown to most. It was the 1st of May, 1966, and the room in which they were sitting was far removed from any bustling military compound where one might expect a clandestine force to be recruiting new members. Instead, they were on the second floor of a meager civilian villa in Da Nang that the U.S. government procured to serve as a safe house. The city was also the home of a major airbase used by both the South Vietnamese and American militaries. The air inside the wood-floored structure was thick and muggy, same as it was outside. Goth and Keller sat in silence, wearing the same standard-issue green fatigues that adorned the dozens of other Green Berets packed into rows alongside them. Most of the soldiers had arrived in Saigon just days before, where they had gone through in-country processing with the 5th Special Forces Group, SFG. There, Goth had learned about the potential new top-secret assignment from Jim Hetrick, another buddy he and Keller had known since their training days. The tension was broken only by the sharp delivery of a powerfully built Special Forces officer as he briefed his audience on their current options. He was a blooded lieutenant colonel, commonly referred to as a light colonel or a light bird in military slang. But there was no disrespect shown to Lieutenant Colonel Raymond L. Cherokee Call as he outlined the daunting proposition facing his potential recruits. A Hoosier with a serious demeanor, Call was elected to serve as a senior commander within the Army's most elite SF organization and oversee all operations at the Da Nang SF Command and Control Headquarters, known as the CNC. The clandestine force he was to command was unknown to the men assembled before him. Some had heard rumors of its existence. Others had even heard its abbreviated name whispered, SOG. Call did not utter the acronym, but instead explained he was recruiting volunteers needed to staff 2 forward operating bases for the purpose of running recon missions into enemy territory. Special Forces personnel to be considered for the assignments were required to possess at least 2 years of service, multiple levels of specialized training, and a rank of at least Specialist 4th Class or Corporal, E4 pay grade. Steve Goth and Al Keller, both of whom ranked as Specialist 4th Class, were the youngest Green Berets present. Goth, 21, had enlisted in the Army in August 1964 after leaving college. The majority of his time had been spent in one form of training or another. Goth and Keller met in jump school and then went through Special Forces Training Group, SFTG, together. After graduation, Steve went to the 3rd Group and Al went to the 7th Group, but both remained stationed at Fort Bragg. The two had gotten to know each other well during that time. Keller learned that Goth was an Army brat born in New Jersey who had spent many years being raised in Europe during his father's tours of duty. At 20, Keller was the youngest man in the room. He had grown up around Washington, D.C., the son of parents who worked for the telephone company. Keller attended Hardin Simmons College in Abilene, Texas. When his first true love didn't pan out, he joined the Army. Some of the Green Berets seated near Keller and Goth learned of the unique assignment while still stateside. Sergeant First Class Jim Stewart first heard of a list being quietly compiled by senior non-commissioned officers, NCOs, in the 3rd, 6th, and 7th groups. Those who volunteered for the top-secret assignment in Vietnam received no further information until they arrived in country. Stewart penned his name to the list without hesitation. Access to the list was closed before some of the guys even knew it was being circulated, he recalled. Stewart and others were quickly gathered in San Francisco, placed on a Boeing 707 airliner bound for Saigon via Hawaii, and in-processed by the 5th Group headquarters at Nha Trang before being flown to Da Nang for their secret assignment briefing. Among the Green Berets whisked from Fort Bragg, North Carolina, to Nha Trang in the previous week were a few with more experience. 28-year-old Sergeant First Class Morris Mo Worley found the whole Vietnam special project to be intriguing. "We asked a lot of questions and got no answers," said Worley, who jumped at the first chance nonetheless. He and his father did not see eye to eye, so Worley finished his senior year of high school living at the local Louisville, Kentucky YMCA while working at a duplicating company in the afternoons to make ends meet. Upon joining the Army in 1956, he was open to new adventure. Worley's initial service was with the 11th Armored Cavalry Regiment, which found him stationed in Germany off and on for the better part of 5 years. During the early 1960s, Worley also saw service in Korea's demilitarized zone, and later back at Fort Knox as a drill instructor. He attended airborne school in October 1964 and completed his special forces training in June 1965. Worley had more military experience than many of his fellow soldiers assembled at the Da Nang briefing, but he was equally green when it came to combat. "Most of your operations will be conducted across the fence," Lieutenant Colonel Call explained. "This means you will be operating behind enemy lines." He further detailed that each man would go in sterile, meaning that they would wear no uniform and carry no weapon or accoutrements that could in any way identify them as being part of the U.S. military. Recon patrols would include a combination of Green Berets and indigenous troops called Nungs, ethnic Chinese who had immigrated to Vietnam from China's Guangxi province. The Nungs had proven their fighting skills during the French Indochina War more than a decade prior. In some cases, the team might also include an officer of the Army of the Republic of Vietnam, ARVN, to assist with their mission. Recon patrols could expect clashes in enemy-held territory with NVA soldiers or their allies, fighters of the People's Liberation Armed Forces of South Vietnam, PLF, who were referred to by American soldiers as Viet Cong, or VC. In the event that anyone was killed or captured while conducting covert missions across the fence, the U.S. government would deny any knowledge of their activity. Their families would simply be notified that they were missing in action, MIA. Such work was exactly why Steve Goth had gotten into special forces in the first place. His mind flashed back to the action-packed James Bond film Goldfinger, which he had seen at the base theater the previous year. Ian Fleming's fictional British secret agent thriller had first hit American theaters in 1962, with Sean Connery starring as Agent 007. By early 1966, American audiences had already been captivated by 4 James Bond films. Goldfinger, the 3rd Bond film, had quickly become the highest-grossing movie of its time, surpassing $124 million worldwide. Goth was still reliving James Bond action scenes as he considered the potential dangers he might face behind enemy lines. But the romance came to an end as he noted the briefing officer turn the meeting over to poker-faced men dressed in black suits with thin black ties. "Obviously CIA guys," thought Goth. One of the black suits reminded the volunteer group that everyone present had special clearance to even hear the secret details they had heard so far, and before proceeding, each man had to make the choice whether this special assignment was something he was fully prepared to accept. "Those who wish to move forward at this point will be committed for 1 full year," he said. "Anyone who wants to decline the opportunity can now simply raise your hand. You will be taken to another room for debriefing, and then will simply be sent back to 5th Group for a new duty assignment. No questions asked." Jim Stewart glanced nervously around the room. No hands went up, but he felt if anyone had raised their arms to opt out, others would have followed suit. After a quiet moment, the briefing officers continued their presentation. "I want to tell you one other thing," Lieutenant Colonel Call added. "Take a look to your left, and then take a look to your right. One of those 2 men beside you will be dead at this time next year." The officer let that fact soak in for a moment before continuing. All right, let's take a break. Go downstairs, grab a Coke or a cigarette. Then, if you're still willing to stay with the unit, come on back up after the break. Goth and Keller shuffled downstairs to talk during the short recess. Well, if Steve will do it, I'll do it, Keller thought. Goth was playing out the same scenario in his mind. He was prepared to move forward with the new Special Forces assignment, since his former jump school buddy also seemed willing. Remembering the colonel's warning, a dark thought, unspoken to his pal, reverberated in Goth's head. Poor old Al is going to be dead next year. The smoke break was short. Goth noted only one man, a Green Beret who had two young children, who declined to return to the briefing. Once everyone was reassembled back upstairs, the colonel resumed his briefing. His new volunteers were to be assigned to one of two forward operating bases, either the one at Kamduk, located just 10 miles from the Laotian border and 60 miles southwest of Da Nang, or a new FOB to be located in the central highlands near the town of Kuntum. At the conclusion of the meeting, a list was posted. Roughly half of the group were slated for service at the Kamduk FOB. The remaining had their names written in for duty at the Kuntum forward operating base, designated as FOB 2. Jim Stewart scanned down the two lists and saw that two of his closest buddies, Harry Whalen and John Ranger Roy, were on the Kamduk list. He then ran his finger down the alphabetized names on the Kuntum list. Billy Joe Anthony, Louis Austria, Jan Borick, Ronald Bowling, John Couch, Alex Fontes, Robert Frank, Stephen Goth, Jim Hetrick, Richard Jenkins, Alan Keller, Charles Kearns, Jerry Lee, James Lively, and Lewis Smith. He hurriedly skimmed toward the bottom of the list. Charles Vessels, Morris Worley. Running his finger back up the sheet, he finally spotted his own name, Jimmy Lee Stewart. Many of these men were complete strangers to each other, but the Green Berets would soon become very well acquainted. The two groups of new recon recruits were ordered to gather their gear and report to the airstrip, where a C-130 Hercules transport was waiting. Located on the eastern coast of the Republic of Vietnam, Da Nang had become the world's busiest airport by 1966. The C-130 was scarcely airborne before the pilot was landing at the FOB at Kamduk. When we landed at Kamduk and I saw that camp, I was certainly happy that I had been assigned to Kuntum, even though I hadn't seen it yet, said Stewart. Whoever located the camp at Kamduk certainly didn't consider defending it. From Kamduk, the next flight was only 75 miles south to Kuntum, where the C-130 landed on the concrete strip of the bustling civilian airport. The Green Berets grabbed their gear and clambered onto a pair of 3/4-ton trucks for the short ride to their new base, south of town. Steve Goth glanced about at Kuntum, a small French colonial rubber plantation town nestled in the Annamite Mountains of the Central Highlands region. Its simple streets were sprinkled with white stucco, red tile-roofed buildings. As their truck approached the fence of a modest gated compound, Goth was enjoying the moment. The sun is shining, and this looks like the start of a great adventure, he mused. The truck jerked to a halt within the old base, and the Da Nang transferees grabbed their personal effects and disembarked. They found that they were the first large contingent of permanently assigned men to arrive at FOB 2. They had been preceded by only a handful of other SF guys who had been similarly assigned from other bases. All told, the new Special Forces base would initially comprise fewer than 36 men, who were soon calling themselves the original Kuntum 33. Leonard Tilley, a staff sergeant with nearly a dozen years in the Army to his credit, was one of the 33 who arrived separately from the big Da Nang bunch. A country boy from Arizona, raised on hunting and fishing, Tilley had been with the third group in HALO, high-altitude, low-opening training at Fort Bragg when he had signed on for the special assignment. Despite his rank over some of the FOB 2 newbies, he was equally uncertain about the nature of his new assignment. Tilley listened as a sergeant checked their names off a clipboard and reminded each man of the new radio code name he would use while on recon duty. Prince. Billy Anthony announced he was Swimmer. Jan Borick said he was Crossbow, and so on. Tilly knew that he was entering an entirely new level of security when he and the others were ordered to remove all the insignia from the uniforms they wore on base. Special forces patches, name tapes, rank chevrons, and qualification badges all had to come off. All of their cross-border gear, from uniforms to rucksacks and web gear, was exchanged for items of Asian origin. The intel passed along in their Da Nang briefing was repeated. Should a team be captured, its members were to state that they had mistakenly crossed into Laos while searching for a downed aircraft near the border. In other words, they would be crossing into enemy territory on missions that were strictly denied by the United States. The prospect of now being a secret agent like James Bond was far removed from Tilly's mind at the moment. All he could think was, oh shit. Chapter 2 Spike Teams and Hatchet Force. Although he tried to suppress his emotions, 44-year-old Colonel John Kirk Jack Singlaub was disappointed when he was handed command of a relatively new operation known as MACV SOG. Having served in special ops in both World War II and Korea, he was hoping for a conventional command when his impending assignment to Vietnam was made known to him in the fall of 1965. His superiors considered Colonel Singlaub to be the perfect fit for the cloak-and-dagger job soon to be vacated by Colonel Donald Blackburn of MACV. Blackburn was the legendary commander of the World War II guerrilla network known as Blackburn's Headhunters, which had been highly successful in disrupting the Japanese military in the Philippines. In May 1965, Blackburn assumed command of the Joint Unconventional Warfare Task Force known as SOG. The Joint Chiefs created SOG in January 1964 to conduct operations in North Vietnam under the direction of the unit's first leader, Colonel Clyde Russell, and his superiors in the Pentagon. SOG was primarily composed of U.S. Army Special Forces personnel, but also included some Navy SEALs, Air Force personnel, CIA agents, and elements of the Marine Force Reconnaissance Units. The United States had committed nearly 200,000 troops to South Vietnam by the end of 1965, but the war with North Vietnam was continuing to escalate. Defense Secretary Robert McNamara approved covert attacks on North Vietnam during 1963, and by early 1964, Lieutenant Colonel Raymond Cherokee Call had been assigned as one of the leaders of Operational Plan OP-34A, a highly classified U.S. unconventional warfare program that developed into SOG. Ray Call was commissioned in Germany during World War II and served in the infantry during the Korean conflict. In 1960, he took a military training team from the 77th Special Forces to Vietnam to set up one of three training teams of Arvin Rangers. The Vietnamese were not all that enthused about it, so they sent me every misfit that they had in their roster, Call said. He immediately put the Vietnamese soldiers through a tough physical fitness regimen until he had only 19 worthwhile men remaining of the 110 he had been first assigned. President Lyndon Johnson used an attack on the destroyer USS Maddox, DD-731, in the Gulf of Tonkin in August 1964 to urge Congress to dramatically escalate the Vietnam War with more U.S. involvement. Lieutenant Colonel Call soon found more U.S. Special Forces collaboration in 1965 with the Arvin Rangers he had trained, and he boldly issued plans for MACV SOG Op 35. It called for direct action and long-range reconnaissance patrols into North Vietnamese territories by American-led recon elements to verify the existence of the Ho Chi Minh Trail and to disrupt the tremendous amount of supplies moving along the trail. The unpaved Laotian infiltration network had been created by the North Vietnamese Communist Party's Central Committee in April 1959, where the Truong Son route, the name used by the NVA, wound covertly through the mountains and jungles. During the height of its use, the trail would carry more than 10,000 camouflaged trucks along 2,000 miles of hidden roads, protected by anti-aircraft, AA guns, and tens of thousands of support troops. Call's Op 35 moved from his boss, Don Blackburn, on to General William Westmoreland, the MACV commander in charge of all U.S. forces deployed in South Vietnam. The chain of command for approvals continued all the way to Washington. SOG was given more flexibility.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?